Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Right, ladies and gents, welcome to this. Thanks for joining us on a session on extreme weather. The weather's not that extreme at the moment, but this is a really important issue that comes up actually in a wide variety of contexts. I'm happy to be chairing a panel. And I'm Jacob Reynolds. I'm the head of policy for the think tank MCC Brussels, as well as an associate fellow of the Academy of Ideas and long-standing contributor and organizer for the Battle of Ideas Festival. This topic of extreme weather is kind of hard to avoid in the media, opening newspapers, or on the evening news, whether it's kind of wildfires in Hawaii and Canada, whether it was the European heat wave over the summer, whether floods all across Europe, Sweden, Slovakia, Czech Republic, or last year, really devastating ones in Germany. And of course, the consensus seems to be that climate change makes these extreme weather events more likely, and that we should kind of think about adapting to a world in which these things become a more common occurrence. Or does it? I mean, there's plenty of argument over whether these kinds of events really are more common or they're just kind of more reported on. There's competing evidence there. And also there's a suggestion that even if they are kind of more common, such as the resilience of kind of increasingly well-developed societies, that these events kind of don't influence or aren't as felt as much as they otherwise might be. There's lots of, for example, competing evidence on the effects of cold and of heat and the amount of deaths, and it can turn into a kind of a macabre kind of competitive analysis of different deaths from different causes. But regardless of that, even if we were to assume that these events are more likely, there's a serious question for our societies about what should we do. Adapting to this and adapting and changing our emissions and all the rest of it to do with climate change would involve an enormous transformation of economy and society, billions, hundreds of billions of pounds of investment. And some people might suggest that that would be maybe just better spent on infrastructure to help us kind of deal with these effects, applying mitigation or, generally speaking, further development so that we can respond more effectively to these crises. So we need to kind of get to grips with a wide variety of questions in that area about kind of what should we do? Are these events becoming more likely? And how should we respond to climate change more broadly? To help us figure this out, we've got a great panel that'll take us through the next hour and 15 minutes or so. And so I'll introduce them briefly in the order that they'll speak. Sitting over here on my far right is Martin Wright, who's the director of a new initiative called Positive News. He's the former editor-in-chief of Green Futures and the former director of Forum for the Future. Then on my immediate right is Harry Wilkinson, who's the head of policy for the Global Warming Policy Foundation. And then this has worked out very nicely. They're all spontaneously arrived in order. But on my left is Laurie Lamon, who's a researcher. He's a writer and an associate fellow at the Institute for Public Policy Research, a co-author of Planet on Fire, a manifesto for the age of environmental breakdown, a kind of long-standing, like many of our panel, are long-standing contributors to the Battle of Ideas Festival on various issues related to green policy and the environment. And then on my far left is Tamandra Hartness, who's a journalist, a writer, and a broadcaster who'll be familiar to many of you from various programs on the BBC and elsewhere, including Radio 4's Futureproofing, and also a series called How to Disagree. She's also the author of Big Data, Does Size Matter? Can we welcome our panel? So So those of you who are familiar with Battle of Ideas events, as you should be, as we're approaching the end of the festival, now you'll. This is one of our standard formats, so we'll have introductions of around 5 minutes from each of our panelists, and then very much out and over to you in the audience to kind of probe them and really dig into this debate more broadly. But without any further ado, I'll hand over to Martin for the first introduction.
Thanks very much, Jacob. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to start in Bangladesh, which is a beautiful country. I've been lucky enough to visit it and work in it on a few occasions. And in Bangladesh, cyclones are a fact of life and all too often a fact of death, too. In 1970, the Bola cyclone killed 300,000 people in the country. Then 50 years later, we had super cyclone Amphan. And it's called super because it was of an order of magnitude more powerful. The wind speeds were up to 170 miles an hour, the strongest ever recorded in the region. And that's not surprising, because thanks to climate change, cyclones are getting worse. Rising temperatures mean there's more energy in the system, there's stronger winds, there's more intense rainfall. So not surprisingly, the death toll from supercyclone Amphan was 26. Not 26,000, 26. Not surprisingly... Not surprisingly, because Bangladesh, which is home to some of the most resourceful people on the planet, had spent the last five decades adapting to the growing demands, the growing impacts of climate change. Its cyclone preparedness program, founded 50 years back in the wake of the tragedy of Cyclone Bola, evolved into one of the world's most sophisticated climate adaptation efforts. It's restored mangroves, it's planted new tree belts, it's protecting vulnerable riverside villages with embankments backed by wide swathe of floodplain pastures, or helped soak up the storm's rages. It's built massive, robust concrete cyclone shelters big enough to accommodate a whole village. It's using the latest satellite technology to give better warnings of an approaching storm. And thanks to its fantastically rapid adoption of solar power to bring electricity and mobile coverage to communities way off the mains grid, people in vulnerable areas get text messages in time for them to find shelter. And so when Amphan was looming, it mobilised tens of thousands of volunteers to evacuate 2 million people from the most vulnerable areas. Put it all together, and the result is the quite astonishing fall in death rates, despite the increased severity of the storms. So in Bangladesh, climate adaptation, it isn't a sort of, shall we? It isn't an interesting subject for academic debate among people for whom climate change barely crossed their minds until it became a stick to whack the woke with. It's a real lifesaver in the here and now. But, and you knew there was going to be a but to rely on adaptation alone is to play, literally, with fire. I said Bangladesh is a super resourceful people, and they are, but it's one thing to adapt to a cyclone, another to adapt to incessant sea level rise, which means the fields you've grazed cattle on for generations are literally disappearing beneath the waves, when the soil gets so saline that nothing will grow. Now, even then, the farmers are adapting. They're investing in aquaculture, growing shrimps, but shrimps won't feed a nation. Coastal villages in Bangladesh are already migrating to cities at the rate of 100,000 per year, and that rate's increasing. It looks likely to move into the millions. Just the sort of inescapable refugee flood that Suella Braverman, with all her famed diplomatic tact, likes to call a hurricane. Ground temperatures in the region are approaching the wet bulb threshold. That's a fatal combination of heat and humidity, which causes the human body to simply shut down. So short of genetically engineering humans so we can cope, or somehow air conditioning an entire country, we're beyond the point of pure adaptation alone as a workable response to the climate crisis. And of course, it's not just places like Bangladesh. Climate will hit us hard too. Our entire civilization across the globe has evolved during a period of remarkable climatic stability, and that period is now coming crashing to an end. Now, we might be able to adapt. Maybe here in Britain we can survive a sudden collapse in temperature if the Atlantic currents shift dramatically and the evidence is increasingly likely that they're about to do so. Maybe when melting ice sheets flood virtually every one of the world's coastal cities, we can have us floating refuges with water from desalination plants on an unimaginable scale and so on and so on. Maybe. But I actually quite like our lovely English climate. I quite like London. The residents of Mumbai, of Shanghai, of New York quite like their cities too. that's worth fighting for. Hence the case for mitigation as well as adaptation, i.e. to slow, even reverse climate change rather than just surrendering to it. And so much of what we need to do to mitigate climate change also helps us adapt to climate change's impacts as well. Whether it's shifting to clean energy, insulating our homes, restoring forests, revolutionising our food system, drawing carbon down out of the atmosphere. This sort of stuff is what we humans are good at. We are good at responding to a crisis by unleashing our creativity, our innovation to meet the challenge. So yes, we have to adapt, but it's a damn sight better and a damn sight kinder to those hundreds of millions of people in the global south who did fuck all to cause a problem we are now condemning them to suffer from, if we actually mitigate it, not just airily tell them to make do and mend. So rather than burying our heads in the sand, clinging to outdated technologies, let's just get on with it. Like the old phrase goes, when's the best time to plant a tree? Best time was 40 years ago. The second best time is now. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. Harry, over to you.
Thank you. I largely agree with a lot of what was said there, but I think there's some important areas where I would disagree, and I'd like to emphasise where those are. I think this topic of adaptation, reveals a lot about how the debate on climate change has gone wrong, in my opinion. Michael Mann, who is one of the most prominent climate scientists out there and sometimes functions as a high priest of the climate movement, has said that on the climate crisis, delay has become the new form of denial. The D word du jour is delay, and we've become all too familiar with the lexicon employed in its service, and chiefly adaptation. So, this sort of arbitrary choice that's presented, adaptation or mitigation, is wrong. Both can be done at the same time. But adaptation shouldn't be seen as a form of denial. There are so many things that we can do to limit the impact of climate change, and we can look to the past as well to see how that's been successful. So my answer to the overall question is absolutely yes, we can adapt to climate change. And let's look at the data on the past, which shows how we've done that. You look at deaths from extreme weather over the last 100 years. They've fallen 95%, despite the global population increasing by a huge amount. So your actual chances of dying in an extreme weather event, as we were hearing, is so much lower than it was before. So you've never been safer in the climate that we have today than you have been in the past. And that's not because the climate has become safer, that's because we're so resilient and we've become much better at dealing with the climate that we have. So I think economic growth has been at the central to that. One thing that's true in the past, true now, and will be true in the future is that the poorest people will be most exposed to the effects of climate change. But that means that, there's an enormous amount that we can do to limit that by pursuing economic growth. And I think, when we talk about net zero and mitigation in contrast, we often talk about, we'll go for renewables. We will pursue clean technologies. But who is the we in this situation? It's competition and consumer choice that reveals which technologies are going to be best to deliver our energy needs. And I'm actually confident that in the future we won't be relying on fossil fuel sources. Clean technologies will, if they're allowed to compete, prevail. But what we have at the moment is an approach that's based on the government saying we'll pursue wind and solar instead. And we're seeing all sorts of costs and prohibitive costs in the UK that's not going to make anyone want to copy what we're doing. So I think, let's look at adaptation in relation to mitigation to compare how effective they will be. The Climate Change Risk Assessment looked at what would be likely for the UK and found in 2080, under 2 degrees of warming, the costs of climate change impacts would be £13 billion a year, and under 4 degrees, it would be £21 billion a year. Now, we're already spending more than that on mitigation. So by actually having an approach that looks at cost effectiveness, we can, you know, optimise how we deal with climate change. So I do think that, you know, future predictions about climate change have to be regarded as much more uncertain than past predictions. We see a jump to blame every extreme weather event on climate change. Hawaii, which was mentioned in the preamble to this event, you know, ultimately it was found that planting new grasses in Hawaii had contributed to the fires. Electrical infrastructure had played a role. And the UN itself concedes that there's low confidence in any trends in wildfires at a global level, storms, floods at a global level. These things aren't actually becoming more frequent yet. In certain places, they're becoming more common. In certain places, they're becoming less common. So there needs to be realism about what the science is actually saying about the data now and how it might change in the future. And there's so many claims about how every extreme weather event is to do with climate change, but that's not what the underlying data is showing.
Great, thanks a lot, Mark Harry. Laurie, your opening thoughts.
I like to go back to what Michael Mann said there. So yeah, this is an American scientist who became quite famous, at least in people who pay attention to scientists, because he created the what's described the hockey stick graph, which showed how unusual the increase in temperature was, and he has remained someone in the public sphere. And the point he was making there is that in the past, the people who profited vastly from putting fossil fuel pollution in the atmosphere tried to subvert the political debate, and they did that through denying the problem existed. As things have racked up and the science has become more certain and people have actually sniffed out what those fossil fuel companies are doing, they've had to move from the denial bit, because it clearly isn't working as a political strategy anymore, to what is described there as delay. So this is saying, well, okay, fine, climate change is happening, but it might not be as bad, or it might not be this, so we should move slower. And the point that he was making, the quote that Harry used, was the fear that adaptation could become part of that delay strategy. Basically, the idea that people will say, look, sure, we've got to do this adaptation. And in fact, because it, you know, the cost of climate change might be this, and the cost of adaptation is this, we should actually spend more time adapting to the problem than trying to stop it in the first place. And I think that Michael, in some ways, is right, because that could be a dangerous strategy. If we spend all our time adapting, we're not going to outrun this thing. We have to deal with the root cause of the problem, and I'll talk about that a bit more in a second. But adaptation to the inevitable impacts of climate change has been hugely underinvested in. The UK right now is hugely unadapted even to the types of climate extremes that we're already seeing. Loads of different parts of society are similarly unprepared for the level of climate change we have. Those of you in the audience who have pensions, I can say with high level of certainty that your pension fund, will not have in its plans for the future an analysis, really, of what risks climate change could present to your pension. A lot of the scenarios that they are using to try and understand how your pension could be at risk because of worsening climate change don't even include extreme weather, let alone some of the more extreme impacts of climate change. So we are chronically unadapted to the climate threat. And one of the great things, I strongly agree with these points that have already been made, one of the great things is that so-called adaptation, stuff that makes us get better prepared and more resilient to a more climate-changed world, can also help us deal with the root cause of the problem. So a great example of this in this country is insulation. We want to insulate our buildings because it would mean that we're better prepared for more climate extremes in the future, but it will also reduce our carbon emissions, partly because we're using less energy. It will also make us more energy secure because we won't be beholden to Vladimir Putin's blackmailing through his control of the gas supply like we have in the last few winters. And it will also mean our homes are warmer, which will be better for health, right? It's very difficult in policy to find win-wins. To get a win-win-win-win is pretty good. But as time goes on, we will have to deal with the root cause of the problem. And one of the main reasons for that is that a more climate change world is a very unstable world. My work that I do now is not, it's not work where I spend time with climate campaigners and people who are sitting in the roads. I spend time with military officers and people in insurance companies and actuaries and other people who are looking at risk in the longer term. They are not people who are going to be swayed by Greta Thunberg or by any of the other signifiers that you see. They'll probably be put off by them, actually, but they are swayed by the risks to global security. They are swayed by what this is doing to geopolitics. They are swayed by threats to things like food supply. And those threats are real, they are manifesting, and we cannot outrun them. You cannot adapt fully to the kind of impacts that we saw in Pakistan recently, where a third of the country was flooded and about a half of the crops were severely damaged by those floods. You can't run away from the fracturing of food supply chains, and you cannot run away from the potential conflict that comes from, say, the melting of the Arctic region, which has always acted as a geopolitical anchor between America and Russian relations. So we can adapt. We should adapt way more. It will help us create a better, more prosperous world anyway. But ultimately, we cannot fall into the trap of thinking that we can adapt and hunker down and that that will help us deal with this problem. We cannot outrun it. Ultimately, we have to deal with the root causes of it.
Great. Thanks a lot, Lauren. And the last of our introductions to Mandra.
Well, this is quite nice to hear that, actually, because it's one less thing for me to worry about because I don't have a pension. So swings and roundabouts. Now, I'd like to talk about risk. I'm picking up perhaps on some of that, partly because that's one of my ongoing obsessions, but also this seems very pertinent to this. And I mean, one of the most common ways to talk about risk is to multiply together the chance of something happening with the impact it'll have if it happens. And that seems to be very relevant to the extreme weather aspect of a changing climate, because when you talk about the increased probability of things happening, which is still very uncertain, but I would say, I mean, personally, I'm inclined to believe that as the amount of energy, as the overall temperature increases, the probability of some things happening at least does increase. I think that's perfectly plausible. I realise that trying to talk to scientists and get exact figures on this is very, very difficult, because that's the nature of uncertainty and probability, but it seems likely. So I actually went looking for some information that wasn't too politically motivated from either side. It was really, really difficult. But I found something that I thought seemed reasonably plausible. UN Climate Change News 2021. So a disaster related to a weather, climate or water hazard occurred every day on average over the past 50 years, killing 115 people and causing $202 million in losses daily, according to this new report. The number of disasters has increased by a factor of 5 over the 50-year period, driven by climate change, more extreme weather, and improved reporting. So perhaps there is some element of, as we become more on top of the science and technology, we are more aware of things that previously might have killed lots of people in an underdeveloped country would have known about. But the number of deaths decreased almost threefold because of better preparation. Again, very much the kind of thing that Martin was talking about. So I think this allows us to not separate out the question of how much more frequent things are going to become as the climate changes from the impact and what it does, but to at least allow us to kind of insert in that the question of how much can we improve this with adaptation. And perhaps because, even though I don't have a pension, I'm getting to the age where you wake up in time to hear Farming Today. I was hearing a lot about flooding, and so flooding was on my mind. So I looked into the recent flooding in the UK this year, and what kind of things were causing it, what could be done about it, what was being done about it. And I was frankly startled by the amount of attention given to people blaming the various water boards for the flooding and the various things that they weren't doing or had done and shouldn't have done to the extent that, quite a few areas and councils seem to be, and even some of the farmers, seem to be suing their local water boards for what they had stopped doing or started doing that could have prevented or at least improved the impact of the flooding. I mean, obviously, a lot of places do have flood defences, and it was quite interesting in fact that some areas that had been hit really hard in the 2014-2015 floods were much better off this time because things have been implemented in the intervening periods, better flood defences, better management of, water flows with the changing rainfall patterns. I mean, this is a slightly personal thing for me because I live fairly near the River Thames, which has the Thames flood barrier, which was built after the really disastrous floods in 1952, I think, which killed hundreds of people down the east coast of Britain as a combination of weather, it was high tides, it was winds, it was weathers, storm surges, really catastrophic flooding. And so the Thames now has this, I may be biased, rather beautiful flood barrier that they regularly use and test that basically stops the tides coming up the river and to some extent manages the flow down the river, doesn't do that quite as well. I should perhaps also say that I live just downriver from it, so if we've got a massive surge, the Thames barrier would protect the rest of London from it. I'd be looking to see how far it came up over the Thames path, which it regularly does. But it basically works quite well, and they said recently, yeah, we think this is still good till 2070. So that's, I take that as something optimistic. In contrast to the area near where my dad lives in Somerset, which suffered catastrophic flooding again in 2014, and looking into what caused that, it was very clear that it was about land management. Now, this is called the Somerset Levels because it's all low-lying area. It's near the Severn estuary, which is very, very tidal, but it also is basically a low-lying kind of swamp area that historically has always flooded. And gradually, they started to manage that in agricultural terms by putting in drainage ditches. There were also, as the area industrialised, there were industries the kind of at the interface between the drainage ditches and the tidal estuary that would literally pump the water out, but they were connected to the industry. So when some of the industries closed down, they stopped the pumping, and then later on they stopped dredging, and then the whole area flooded in 2014, and the farmers were absolutely furious. And this actually, and that they are now not only reintroduced dredging, but they're also building a tidal barrier. But one of the other things that was talked about was the fact that this was a deliberate policy to reduce the dredging and change the water management because they wanted to give some of the land back to nature, allow it to naturally flood. So, and another thing that I heard, so this takes me back to the another thing on the farming today, which is one of the farmers saying, well, you know, one of the things that's being suggested in this other area to manage the floods is that we turn this into a kind of fenland, wetlands, wildlife thing, and that'll soak up some of the flooding. But on the other hand, this is fertile land and we'd like to grow food on it. So managing risk is about mitigating impacts as well as probability. So just to sum up, the thing that worries me about the way we are failing to manage some of these impacts when we could is that in an era when a lot of people that we look to take responsibility for getting things done and managing things are not really taking responsibility. One of the excuses that comes very readily to hand is that, oh, well, it's climate change. So that a water board, instead of saying, oh, well, we really messed up there, we should have put in a better drainage system, we should have not mothballed that reservoir, they say, oh, well, it's climate change. And this enables them to do two things. One is to just get off the hook of doing their job, which we give them money to do. But the other one is, in some ways, it allows them to take the moral high ground because they sometimes say, well, it's your fault. It's your fault that your house has been flooded because it's climate change. It's basically your fault. And I realised I could coin the phrase sins of emission. I'm sorry, I'm only on these panels because of my bad puns, and this is your pun of the day. So the thing that worries me about the adaptation is that we could be doing it, and the reason we're not is that it fits too neatly into an agenda where, well, it's climate change, what can you do? And the answer is we could do a lot more than we are doing.
Great. Thanks a lot, Samantha. Yeah, I actually really want to return to these issues of kind of the man-made element, not just man-made climate change, but kind of man-made incompetence as well, the kind of management of these things. But I want to get out and get some questions, and maybe we can tease that out a bit as well. Okay, you got the microphone. Just pass it to the lady who's closest to you. There we go.
Hi, I lived in Bangladesh for a half a year, 30 years ago, and you're right, great place. But I wanted to say that 30 years ago, there was a lot of poverty, not all poverty, but a lot of poverty. And I've kept in touch with some of the people that I lived with, and there's still a lot of poverty. Some of my friends have gone to Dakar, capital city, or gone internationally, but some are still in the villages. And they don't have what we have. And the reason, a lot of the reason, is then and now, is because it's frowned upon to have economic growth. And so the international aid, or what they were looking at to get, doesn't give them anything like we have. And so they don't have that. Adaptation, they do very well. But just I'm just trying to think, what would it be like if Bangladesh did have economic growth and all their ingenuity? My God, something different. So I'm with Harry on the economic growth, and I wonder where you two lie in that, or you three lie in that. And second quick point, on from that, it feels, and forgive me because I feel like I'm having a go at you, but I don't mean to. It feels a bit mealy-mouthed when we talk about adaptation and mitigation, because again, I wonder what we could do if we just took the heat out of it and just thought really big. And I'm not even thinking big here, but here, nuclear power, not happening. And if we could only think much bigger, then perhaps we here could really have even a better life, and people in Bangladesh could really get something. And it feels like if I lived what you wanted me to live, Martin, I wouldn't get that.
Nice one. Thanks. All right, good challenge. All right, so just pass it across the aisle to that gentleman.
Firstly, I completely agree with the nuclear question. I think that, you know, the U.S. has cut the investment in nuclear fusion reactions by about 50% every year for the last 20 years. And, you know, MIT was closed 20 years ago, and they're no closer today because of that. The other thing that I would... like to ask you, Harry, is that, you know, you said, you know, the adaptation cost in, you know, 80 years might only be $13 billion. Now we're spending, today we're spending more on mitigation, but in the, essentially the same sentence, you said that the models for that far in the future have shown to be really unpredictable. So why are you betting our future being, you know, instead of spending the money to mitigate now, why are you relying on it being cheap to adapt in the future, when you've said that it's unpredictable what's actually going to happen that far out?
Yeah, all right, great challenge. So just pass it to that gentleman in the hat.
Thanks. It's long,
is it? Yeah, it is.
Very good. Okay. This is an ultimate example of luxury belief. What we're talking about now. But unfortunately, it's not a luxury for the poorest 2 billion people in the world who are denied affordable electricity, clean water, and affordable cooking. That means that half of those people, the women, die prematurely from breathing in particles from charcoal, which their husbands and sons are out cutting them down in the forest for, and die. Whatever we do will make no difference at all to anything. The Chinese and the Indians are going to do nothing. But we encourage the World Bank to prevent people from getting affordable electricity. We prevent the development of nuclear power. I live on Faversham Creek. 60 years after the 53 flood, just before I was born in Yorkshire, there was another flood. It came halfway up my garden. I'm not moving anywhere. I'm much more worried about the 1,000 acres of glass out on the one bit of the marsh, which is not a triple SI or a bird reserve. 1,000 acres of glass and a 750 megabyte lithium-ion battery, which when it blows up, when it blows up, will be the equivalent of 120 megatons of tons of TNT, and will, depending on the wind direction, pour toxic gas into my tank.
Now,
all right. One more thing. I've been researching this for 30 years when all this nonsense started trying to scare my children. Now it's trying to scare my grandchildren, and I'm even more involved. Now I'm not going to keep quiet.
Great. Thank you. All right. There's already quite a few things to come back on, so maybe just pick up a few quick points. Laurie, I'll start with you this time.
I'll do the one about the unpredictability. The UK government, I think this maybe relates to the figures you were quoting, Harry, in the UK government's climate change risk assessment, which it does every 5 years to assess the risk of climate change, it does use modelling to try and work out what is a very unpredictable future. I mean, the future is unpredictable. The climate system is unpredictable. We do know it's heading in a certain direction, though, overall. They use models that basically don't deal with the unpredictability quite well. And the figure that it gets is that by 2045, under 2 degrees of global warming, the costs that the UK could face are about 1% of GDP. And if you are a minister, or anyone really, and you hear that, you say, it's not that expensive. It's probably much less than COVID cost, for example. And it further feeds into this idea that this is something that on the margin, as we balance up the cost, doesn't sound actually that serious. The problem, as with many things in the world, is that economics and economic modelling is pretty bad at being able to predict these kind of things. It's the same kind of modelling, for example, that when applied to, say, Yemen and labour productivity, says that by the year 2100, under 3 degrees of global warming, the drop in labour productivity, the ability for people to work productively outside, will be about 17%. The idea that we can accurately forecast the drop in labour productivity in Yemen by 2100 in a world in which we've warmed by 3 degrees is ludicrous. And it's in fact, actively dangerous because it feeds into this complacency. If we have a 3 degrees rise in temperature, something that hasn't happened in that period of time for millions of years, and definitely in which societies, including people in Yemen, have not lived under, the last thing they'll be worrying about is labour productivity. They'll be worrying about their food supply. They'll be worrying about regional wars above and beyond what we already experienced. So there is, unfortunately, when it comes to the very adult game of trying to model the risks into the future, a huge underestimate of what those risks are going to be.
Nice. I like this question of dealing with unpredictability. I'm sure we'll get back to it because it throws up the interesting question of, when dealing with unpredictability, should we stick on the precautionary side, or do we take it in the other direction and say, well, it may well turn out all right, which might be too Banglossian, but is certainly a live option. Harry?
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of go back to some of the remarks I made earlier. And I think to summarise that, you know, we are now living in a world in which the climate has never been less relevant to our living standards as a global population. And the big risk, I think, of this obsession with climate change is that we're viewing everything through the prism of climate change when there are much bigger determinants of our living standards. You know, the corruption and the bad governance of many poorer countries around the world are what are holding them back. And if there was just a tiny percentage of the focus that we give to climate change on dealing with some of these governance and economic issues, then we could achieve so much more. And then a happy side effect would be that these richer countries would be better prepared to deal with climate change. You know, when it comes to mitigation, we've just seen, you know, disaster after disaster. The only countries which have achieved deep decarbonisation of their electricity systems are ones which either have nuclear or hydro, or a mixture of both. And they didn't do that because their governments were pursuing a policy of decarbonisation, but it was a happy consequence, and they ended up with very low carbon intensities. And now we have a sort of global international movement pushing for wind and solar to be expanded very quickly, without consideration for the costs of that, and despite the fact that it hasn't been proven to be a successful strategy to decarbonize electricity grid.
Yeah. No, okay, no, we'll leave it there. I think we're going to come back to this issue of nuclear, certainly. But, Martin, a few thoughts?
Oh, a few. Nice to hear Harry talking about the climate change is real and it's a problem. I think Nigel Lawson must be turning in his grave. Wind and solar. The International Energy Agency for years and years and years told us that wind and solar would never work, that it would only contribute 2 or 3% of the global electricity supply, et cetera, et cetera. And they've completely changed their tune in the face of the spectacular falls in the cost of wind and solar and the successfully and spectacular rollouts that have been happening across the world, including, incidentally, in Bangladesh, some of the most dynamic business people I have ever met, a Bangladeshi, rolling out solar power in a way that is helping local people double, triple their income, making a real difference to their lives in the here and now.
Can I briefly push you on the wind and solar thing? Just because somebody in one of the sessions yesterday was making a point that there's this danger of kind of offshoring some of our emissions, because, and they gave the example, and you can correct us on this, but they gave the example of, say, producing solar panels or wind farm components in China, where they're very energy intensive production, using loads of fossil fuels to burn to get them built. But then when the solar panel arrives in Bangladesh or something, it seems like Bangladesh is on the way to net zero. But actually all of the emissions have just been done in China.
A huge amount of stuff is outsourced to China. I mean, vast quantities of stuff is outsourced to China. It doesn't always have to be the case. You know, we need to be careful not extrapolating from present trends. You know, there is politically motivated, interestingly enough now, increasing onshoring of production, and I think that will continue, and there's no reason why it shouldn't, especially as we start to do things like using hydrogen to make steel and so on. So these are, you know, really significant changes in the way we run the motors of our economy, if you like.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. No, it was good to clarify that, because someone was talking about that. Tamandra?
I'd like to come back to some of the points of the audience, but just kind of springing off something Harry said, I think it's not that we see everything through the prism of climate change, it's that we increasingly see everything through the prism of risk. So it's quite interesting that in this debate we're kind of saying, well, perhaps we should focus more or less on the risk of climate change and stopping it, and more or less on the risk of particular weather events and whether we can adapt to them directly. But they are, in a sense, just slightly different applications of the same principle, which is the way you should think about all human life is that it's a series of risks to which we are subject and to which we have to respond in various ways as possible victims of these risks. And I think, at the risk of being self-contradictory, I think it's a very dangerous way to see life, that in fact, I mean, I like the idea of thinking big and not thinking, oh well, is it, you know, which should we do, adapt or mitigate, that actually we could think in terms of projects for the future, that perhaps we could have economic growth that would give copious amounts of clean energy and also more resilience against the vagaries of nature, that perhaps, I mean, I think it's very important what the Faversham guy said about, if you don't mind being Faversham guy, about the fact that, I mean, when people talk about the dangers of air pollution, most of the deaths in the world from air pollution are from people who cook over burning stuff indoors, and they do that because, unlike us, they don't have a luxury of going, oh, I'm not sure, gas stove or induction hob, which should we do? They are literally burning stuff in their house with inadequate ventilation over which to cook and to heat everything. I mean, I suppose not unlike what our grandparents and great-grandparents did when everything in the house ran on coal, but that it shouldn't be an either-or. It shouldn't be, well, you know, maybe we should mitigate climate change by keeping everyone in poverty, or shall we adapt by building stuff? It should be very much what we need is a project of how can we keep making human life better, and that will include being less subject to natural disasters and having cleaner air, but also having more access to energy. And I really think it's a huge mind shift. I mean, you kind of touched on the idea of the precautionary principle, which is the idea that faced with an uncertain risk, what you should do is always default to, well, perhaps if we don't know what the risks are, we shouldn't do it. But that would be a disastrous path where we are now, because there are always going to be risks in new technologies. I mean, you're concerned about the risks of what if a lithium battery in solar farm goes up? People who panicked when Fukushima went up and closed all the nuclear power stations in Germany went back to burning coal. And that was nuts, frankly. No disrespect to any Germans here, but it's one of the worst decisions a government's made in the last century, I think.
Yeah. The other German government decisions may top that one. But, we'll move our way forward. So there's that guy on the other side of the aisle, and then we'll move forward and take these. I won't forget you, but just keep your hands up. There's two at the back as well.
Hi. It was good to hear Marnie talking about development in Bangladesh. And the examples you gave were actually quite impressive. Obviously, Bangladesh's economy has improved massively in the last 25 years or so. And you mentioned concrete bunkers, you mentioned satellite technology, improved road networks. I was just reminded that actually a lot of those things are frowned upon in the West. You know, so after the floods in the 1950s in the UK, we actually built all of those flood defences, not just the London barrier, but all, if you go all around it, you see massive concrete on the beaches, which are there as flood defences to withstand it in the future. But now, in this country, one of the big things that we're not supposed to use is concrete, massively energy intensive. When it comes to satellite technology, one of the things that we're not supposed to use now is cloud computing, donating 4% of all carbon emissions. So, you know, everything has a problem if you look at it that way around. And Bangladesh might have the luxury of being at the right moment in their development where they don't see it as a problem. But let me tell you, the West sees it as a problem that they're doing it in the first place. And that for me is a really interesting dilemma, that it's not just outsourcing the emissions that Joel was talking about, but it's more the fact that when you have development in this country taking place, and it doesn't happen very often, but when you have industry in this country, you tend now to buy the carbon credits from those countries that you don't think need or deserve to develop in the first place. So whether it's the Maldives, whether it's parts of Africa, we're buying the carbon credits so we can do whatever we want to do, but they don't have to because they are underdeveloped, and what do they need carbon credits for because they haven't got the industry. So that's one thing. Second thing I just want to quickly say is that for me, the reading of the situation about how we understand our role, humanity's role in this, is exemplified by these words, resilience, adaptation and everything. Because in the past, it was development. It was overcoming natural barriers. Then we had adaptation, and adaptation meant that it's going to happen, but we have to work out how we're going to deal with it. And resilience is like the worst of all possible worlds, or as you say, it's going to happen, we can't do anything about it, but how are we going to rebuild afterwards? And it's the ultimate kind of passivity in an understanding about, you know, human relationship to the natural world, and that's, for me, the real philosophical dilemma.
All right, nice one. So you have to keep putting your hands up, because I can't remember exactly where you're all placed. So let's get it to this guy over here, then we're going to take the front, and then I think there's some in the back. Do we have two microphones? Yeah. Oh, so you've got that one, so you should speak. Yeah, and then we'll take this guy.
So Timandra said we could turn some of the land into wetlands to soak up the water, but we wanted to make food on that land.
It's on, we can hear you.
Okay, sorry. So what do you think of using regenerative farming techniques?
Do you want to say what regenerative farming techniques are?
Yes, sure. So rewilding the land, but at the same time still farming and... So, you know, producing organic products and things like that.
All right. You're going to get better for next year on explaining regenerative farming. We might even have you on the panel. There's this gentleman here.
Thanks very much.
If you can stand, that'd be great.
Just about an excellent, thank you. Well, this is a battle of ideas, so here's an idea. I don't believe that CO2 is at all responsible for climate change.
We need
more CO2, not less, because food production will become more of an issue as we continue to cool, as we move towards the grand solar minimum. However, that's just my rather radical view. The question I'd like to ask the panel is the globally accepted measure of atmospheric CO2 comes from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, and that's been producing data for the last, I think, since 1930. And that's shown an exponential rise in CO2 every single year, despite the, what we're in at COP28 and God knows how many WEFs, power Paris Accords, Tokyo Accords, and all sorts of things, none of the things that have been recommended in any of those meetings has had any effect whatsoever on global levels of CO2. So what mitigation are you actually talking about?
Okay, is there someone with the microphone in the back? Yes, go ahead, and then we'll take this lady at the front. That's fine, you're still allowed to speak. You just happen to have the microphone. Okay, but use your initiative and pass it to the nearest person you see. The thing you have to remember, the lights are super bright here, so I don't always see everybody. So, and then you can bring that microphone. No, I said this lady, sorry. So you bring this microphone, and then someone with the microphone there. Cause, no, that's a lady, yeah. That's not...
There's no lady, that was
one. Yeah, so this guy's going to speak first. And sorry, I've completely lost control of this panel. It's the end of a long weekend, so you have to forgive me.
Great, so I think it might be helpful to hear some things around solutions rather than just kind of who's to blame. The main narrative seems to be around net zero, and I agree with the gentleman in the red hat that there doesn't seem to be enough global coherence to kind of make it happen. Even if we can make it happen in this country, we're only responsible for 1-2% of global emissions, and that's probably likely due to the offshoring that was mentioned earlier. And even if we do start to implement net zero within this country, we see that it doesn't actually work, right? We had the Sadiq Khan's ULEZ report that he tried to bury, where it showed that the ULEZ zone actually had no positive impact and potentially a negative impact on the stuff that he was trying to do. So I guess when we're talking about the best time to plant a tree is 40 years ago and the second best time is now, what can we actually do to start making a difference rather than just playing this weird kind of blame shift game?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. We'll take this lady in a second. I want the panel to reflect on that, because it's like, I might not be the cards on the table. I might not be the world's greatest fan of the climate lobby. But one thing I maybe hate more than that is this sense that, oh, there's nothing we can do, you know, China... India, like, we're just, like, kind of poor people in this, like, there's nothing we could do. Like, that kind of throwing our hands up in the air. And I think challenging some of that narrative, even if it's, whether it's pro or anti-green movements and renewables or whatever, that's something we need to get to grips with. So you, and then we'll come to the panel.
Yeah, I'm quite pessimistic about the climate change, whether we can adapt to it. Because on the larger scale, I think the climate, maybe it's not, human activities probably only change a little bit on the larger scale, like dinosaur age, you know, or the ice age. That's like a big scale than what human activities can compare. The second thinking is, even if we were trying to do a lot of adaptation strategies in the government or international communities or promoting green, like low carbon footprints, whatever. I think basically, I think when people find it hard to change their living lifestyles, a lot of people like Western. I'm from China, and you mentioned China and India. But I think compared to Westerners, we use less energy, like in lots of ways. People here take baths very frequently. In China, most houses or flats, most people live in houses and flats without bathtubs. We only take showers. And so here, I think it's hard for people to change their lifestyle because you're used to having baths. It's just lots of water wasted, electricity, lots of house appliances. And so very hard for people to change. And also, you can see lot of land, the rubbish piles up and landfill. Feel quite pessimistic about it.
Yeah, okay, that's directly related to this. So we need to challenge some of the pessimism. We need to kind of get some of the facts in order and deal with this question of risk. There's plenty on the table. You're looking at me, so I'm assuming you're ready to answer, Harry.
Yeah, I just want to come back against that pessimism and asking people to change their lifestyles. You know, many people in this world are much poorer than we are, and of course they aspire to have better living standards, and that will drive a lot of increases also in CO2 emissions from fossil fuel use. Now, fossil fuels make up about 80% of global energy, primary energy production, and that hasn't changed much with the introduction of renewables, maybe just a few percent. So people should aspire to better lives, but the beautiful thing is, You know, we're becoming more and more efficient at using resources. Fridges today use just a fraction of the energy that they used before and have a much smaller impact on the environment. And that's multiplied across so many different products. So, you know, developing countries go on an environmental Kuznets curve, as it's called. So when they're in that initial process of industrialization, yes, there are consequences for the environment, but then as they get richer, they have more money to think about, you know, how sensitive they want to be to the environment. So people should aspire to more, and the quicker we can get people on that curve and then coming down again, the better. And we shouldn't get in the way of developing countries' aspirations. And so when Western countries say they don't want to finance fossil fuel projects in the developing world, they are slowing those countries' development. They're doing an enormous disservice to them. And they're letting actually countries like China fund those projects instead. You know, we have been seeing lots of diplomatic problems, for example, over Ukraine, with countries in Africa, for example, not supporting the Western approach on Ukraine. We've lost touch with what these countries need, and we're preaching to them what energy technologies they should use.
Nice. Okay. I pick up anything you like, Laurie. Especially interested in this question of China grappling with the like developing world and the energy needs they might have. There's plenty on the table.
A few decades ago, I think it was in the early 90s, a high-ranking Chinese politician said, "While the Middle East has oil, China will dominate rare earths." And throughout human history, the sort of hegemonic power in the world has often partly been there because it's done exceptionally well out of dominating the new energy wave of the future. This country and the British Empire did it with coal in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. America did it with oil in the 1900s. And there is a race on now to dominate the next wave. And in this country, in some political circles, that reality isn't so much in people's minds politically. It's stuck in this sort of cul-de-sac of, you know, getting annoyed with just a poll and so on, which I can understand why people would do. It's not in the geopolitical reality of how things are changing. We can talk about how some of the solar technology that China is building and exporting around the world is built with electricity, you know, with factories that are powered by coal power plants. But we can also mention at the same time that China is installing more renewables capacity in months than most Western countries are doing in the space of years. And they're not doing that because they are on the phone to Greta Thunberg and the Chinese elites are quaking and going like, "Oh, well, Greta said we should be..." They're doing it for cold, hard, geo-economic reasons and because these technologies are the waves of the future. And it is right that Britain, or at the moment we're in a situation where Britain isn't doing enough of that. Just if you get a black cab and you happen to get one of the electric ones, that's made by a Chinese company. How is it the London black electric vehicle is made by a Chinese company? And it is because this country has not invested in its industrial capacity for a very long time. And I strongly agree that we should, that no country should get in the way of particularly so-called developing nations being able to develop their industrial capacity. But we don't want to support them necessarily in developing coal power plants, partly because we're in a situation now where the economics, per what China's doing, actually works better in the favour of some renewables. Some of the more polluted places on the earth are ones with coal power plants because they have coal power plants. So people have been to some Indian cities. There's cities in, say, Kazakhstan that suffer from this particularly. So we're in a situation where, whether we like it or not, whatever we read, which, you know, forum that we spend all our time reading online that sends us information about whether climate change is real or not, whether we read any of that or not, the geoeconomics and market forces are beginning to shift. And the question for all of us here is whether we're going to ensure that Britain gets a share of the huge benefits that come from that. And at the moment, because of decades of a failure to actually have an industrial policy in this country, we are not set to get those benefits, and that has to change.
Nice one. OK, Samantha. We'll come back out in a second, yeah.
First, I'm going to address the question that's put to me about am I in favour of regenerative farming techniques. Can I just say, nearly all of what I know about farming I hear when I wake up too early and listen to Farming Today, or I am not an expert in regenerative farming techniques. The point I was trying to make when I reported the conversation that the farmer saying, well, look, you know, this area of land has been turned over to fenland as a sponge to protect us from flooding, but we'd quite like to be growing food on that land, is that there are different ways to approach problems. And the way that was being imposed there was that the answer to increased risk of flooding was to give over some land, which would also go back to nature and so on. And he said, well, you know, actually, but we need to grow food and we'd like to be growing food on it. And so he presumably would have favoured the an alternative method that involves drainage ditches, pumping and so on. And but I think what that reflects is, what are your attitudes? I mean, this comes to your kind of fatalism point. And what are your attitudes to how you approach problems, or if you like, opportunities, or like changes, how you approach adapting to change? And one approach is to look at it in terms of limits. Say, well, look, there are just limits to what we can do. And if we're going to have increased risk of flooding, that means we have to accept we'll have less land to grow food on, because we'll have to give more over to nature as an absorbent thing. I mean, as it happens, we've become so much better at growing food that we need some ridiculously tiny proportion of what our ancestors needed, even though there's far more of us. So, you know, arguably, we can do without some of the land. But I just think it's much more of a how we approach these things. If we say, well, look, what we want is we want to be protected from flooding, and we want nature, and we want to grow food. What's the most ambitious, the best way we can do? You talked about people being unwilling to change their lifestyles. Well, people have changed their lifestyles a lot, certainly in this country. Most people's lifestyles have got a lot better in the last century in this country, and people were generally very happy with that. The point is, how can we have a thing where, you know, you talked about insulation. We've not even adapted to the climate we have now. There's not even, you know, people still live in houses they can't afford to heat, that are damp, that are falling down. It's like, we haven't even adapted to this climate. Never mind a warmer climate in 30 years' time. Why aren't we thinking big? Why aren't we going, how can we solve these problems and make people's lives better?
All right, nice one. Martin, if we keep it short, we can come back out for some more questions.
Absolutely. How can we solve people and make people's lives better? I absolutely agree. I think one of the things that frustrates me about some of the resistance to embracing green technology, it's a sort of neo-Luddite attitude in a lot of people who are reluctant to address climate change. It's sort of, you know, when we shifted from stripping trees to burning coal, that was progress. When we shifted from burning coal to burning gas, which is cleaner and more efficient, that was progress. It doesn't automatically mean it stops there. We don't have to be wedded to existing technologies, you know. Shifting to renewable electricity, renewable power, smart insulation, nuclear power when it's affordable. People keep holding up nuclear power as this fantastic solution. It's extremely slow to build. It's very expensive. It's one of the most expensive energy sources on the planet. That's why it's not doing so well. I think there are a lot of opportunities a bit further down the line in small modular reactors. There's a lot of opportunities, quite a lot further down the line, in nuclear fusion. But let's not get stuck with this, as I say, this neo-Luddite attitude to clinging on to existing technologies because nothing's ever going to change.
Okay. That's great. Well, I have to leave it there because I just want to get load more hands. We'll try and get everyone in, and then the panel will sum up briefly. So let's start with the nearest one. The other microphone is there another? Yes, there is. It may be useful if it's somewhere else, such as at the back. And we'll start with this lady here. If you can stand for the camera, it's helpful. But
hi, thank you very much. I just want a quick point to Martin before I go on to. I'm sorry,
Laurie.
Before I go on to Laurie's last point, I think it's interesting that you are, sorry to say this, Martin, but you come across as you want to belittle people who don't agree with you a little bit, Luddite, and you know, the way you talk about Suella Braun. I may agree with what you say, but unfortunately, it does make people resistant, and I just wanted to put that out there. Because people read this stuff and they think, oh God, they're getting at us again. But now, more seriously, I want to go on to Laurie's point about the under-resourcing. My feeling, I mean, I come from a science background. It's not a climate science background, but I have taken a bit of an interest in it. But I think one of the problems we have in this country, and we've seen it now for two or three decades, is there is a, I'm looking around to the audience, there are quite a lot of young people here, which is good. People are not studying science at university. That's what we need to be doing. And I'm not just talking about data science, no offense, but not just talking about data science, political science. all sorts of things get science tagged on to the end of them now to make them sound a bit more intellectual. But I'm talking about the physical sciences, the sciences that do things, the sciences that really discover what actually
okay.
is.
No, great, like it. Okay, so pass it. There's a gentleman here, then it'll be you. There's someone on the microphone right now, so you speak right at the back, and then you. People just don't listen to
them.
The person with the microphone at the back will speak.
Take exception and follow from this comment here. Sorry, the gentleman on the far left, I don't know your name. You use the term neo-Luddite thing.
It's really got people going.
I'm familiar with a very recent comment that was put out by the head of the IPCC, who basically, the statement that he made just last month, are you aware of that?
No, well, just tell us, come on.
Okay, basically said that we just don't know how we're going to cope with a temperature of a degree warmer in 50 years' time. And we need to stop all the craziness. It's counterproductive, it's not helping. And I would say to that comment about neo-Luddite, why don't we just say to him, okay, let's embrace technology, but let's not scare the bejesus out of our kids and everybody as if the climate's going to burn. That's my point. So, yes,
okay.
We can have a balanced conversation.
Nice one. OK, this gentleman at the front.
Thank you. Just one point about coming back to your nuclear bill. We built Calder Hall in less than 5 years, and the Chinese and the Koreans are building them for a capex of less than half than we can do. So the reason nuclear is expensive here is because we make it so. But the main point I wanted to make is the thing about risk. And consider what the risk of the end state of people who are advocating mitigation. So if you look at the National Green ESO Future Energy System report, they don't explicitly say it, but if you go through the numbers, they want per capita energy use to halve by 2050. There's a huge economic and social risk associated with halving energy use. That will put us on as par with countries like Uruguay and Ecuador and Mexico. Now, the counter argument to that is, oh, well, we'll get some efficiencies because we'll all drive electric cars and use heat pumps. But that doesn't take account of the fact that the energy return on energy invested of solar and wind, and particularly when you add in batteries or hydrogen or some of the means of storage which is required, drops through the floor. So if we've got an energy system now that operates on a URI of about 30 and move to something that goes has an energy return on energy invested of about 3, you still need the same amount of gross energy mm-hmm. to produce the net. So if we're going to talk about risk, think about the risk of the end state. And the end state of renewables is, as far as I can see, not very attractive.
Okay, nice one. So if you don't put your hands up, I literally cannot see. So that microphone there, take to that lady here. Pass that microphone to the guy at the front. We'll then get that guy with the tie, and then we'll take this guy at the front. If you've forgotten that, so have I. So there's that lady there. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. So one of the things that was mentioned was that there is too much focus on climate when there are other important issues that are at hand. And on that topic, since climate vulnerability is not just influencing climate itself, but it has implications in wide range of development issues. And it has been shown that, especially it's in the developing countries that are more vulnerable to climate change. So doesn't it make sense for us to consider this lens that allows us to tackle multiple different issues at the same time? And isn't it more helpful to not put pursuing mitigations and adaptation towards climate change as opposed to development, but especially in terms of adaptation, those two are objectives that needs to go together.
Okay, great. So there's this gentleman. Bring that microphone down to this gentleman here at the front. Right, you, yeah.
Question for the panel. Do you know if the world has ever been hotter than it is now or hotter than any of the models are spewing out? And if so, how did we cope?
Great. Nice and pithy, yeah. That microphone, is there any more hands, or are we kind of there? Okay, yeah, so take that guy in the tie, but first you.
My question is very brief. It relates to the Loss and Damage Fund. And I would like to hear your views or opinions. Should developed countries support developing countries by cushioning them financially from the effects of the climate change which they're experiencing?
Yeah. Nice one. Okay, you, then I think there's one more guy at the back. So you, that guy, and then we take the panel to wrap up.
Just to follow up on the point that the lady made earlier about scientific literacy,
Would you forgive me for asking what your formal qualifications are in science? Can you tell us what your BSc, your MSc, and your PhDs are?
Maybe the latter. I should say what theirs are.
I'm going to have a strict no giving my credentials policy. So nobody feel free to answer that if you like. There's a gentleman with the mic.
I don't know about hotter. I think the planet probably has been hotter, but I just wanted to point out, obviously, there was an ice age 100,000 years ago, and obviously people did survive through, did adapt to temperatures that were minus 5 to 10 degrees colder than they are today. So we have adapted in the past, obviously much less technology than we have today. I'm sure you're aware of Bjørn Lomborg's book, so his recent book, in which he has lots of graphs, but he shows, he's got lines that show sort of no, if we did nothing, business as usual, this is what would happen. If we went all out on, reducing mitigation, then we'd be here. And obviously it's going to be something in the middle. The common sense tells you, we're going to do something, but we're not going to go to one extreme. We're not going to go to the other. So the only question is kind of what that looks like and what level of adaptation mitigation we take. I think COVID is sort of a good example of how dealing with adversity, because it shows you the global problem. We have to respond to nations, really, because that's the democratic system we have, and countries are going to make their own choices. So I guess my question is, and to do that, you have to put an amount of GDP aside to deal with that problem. But it just doesn't seem like countries are doing that. So how do we get to the point where countries can take it seriously enough to put aside whatever that is to 1, 2, 3% of GDP?
Yeah. Okay, great. There's loads on the table, from the kind of distinctions between developing and developed countries to the question around nuclear to this kind of, I like these points about, like, are we actually creating enough stuff? Are people interested in even doing that anymore? Have we kind of lost confidence in development? So there's loads to kind of pick on. Let's do the order in which we initially spoke. I'll give you a minute. So, Martin.
Oh, right, OK. So I'll start with an apology. I'm not meaning to put anyone down when I'm talking about neo-Luddite tendency. It's more that repeatedly people say that those people who are concerned about climate change are Luddites or against technological improvement, etc. I'm really in favour of technological improvement. I'm really in favour of opportunity and human ingenuity and progress and development. And I think we can do that while cracking climate change. And that's really, that is our real challenge. And we can do it. We reach for the stars, us human beings. We're really good at this stuff. I'll rise to your challenge, sir. No scientific qualifications whatsoever. But I have talked to an awful lot of scientists over the years. One of the extraordinary things is seeing over the last 40 years the shift in opinion among scientists, who started off, many, many, many of them, being deeply sceptical that there was any real issue around climate change, and slowly, slowly, slowly being dragged, often kicking and screaming, into something approaching a consensus. It's been an extraordinary process. The same thing has happened with business. The same thing has happened with governments.
OK. Yeah, OK, nice one. We'll save all the applause for the end, but I'll come to Harry.
Thank you. Yeah, two sort of points to finish on. One is that economic progress comes through consumer choice. So when we're talking about, are people being Luddites about green technology, no one needed to ban the horse and cart for people to adopt the motor vehicle, which ultimately pushed up oil consumption. These happen from consumer choice. So let's make sure we have competitive markets that help us to find the technologies of the future. Mm-hmm. And then finally, on what are the forecasts? How much will we have to adapt? So much of the scientific literature which looks at this uses RCP 8.5 scenario, which makes all sorts of assumptions about radically increasing coal use, which most scientists now don't regard as very plausible. So let's look at the assumptions as well. And remember that we have never been safer. We're getting safer from this hostile environment. The human condition has been that we've been adapting. That's been what our lives on the planet Earth have been, and we've been getting better at it. So we can look forward to continuing to thrive.
Nice way to end. Harry, Laurie.
The world is getting hotter than it's been for a very long time. The point is that can we deal with that with our modern societies and as fast as the rate of temperature is changing? And that is something that's very doubtful if we continue in the way that we are. But even if that wasn't the case, even if every single IPCC report was incorrect, every supercomputer had got the calculations wrong, the entire scientific community was making stuff up, even if all that was the case, the things we need to do with the deal with the problem, we should have been doing anyway. We should be insulating people's homes better. We should be using regenerative agriculture. We should be seeking types of ways to create electricity that don't poison people's lungs, and on and on and on. And even if all of this is some grand hoax like the forums that some of you are reading says it is, then we'd still be doing these things. We should be doing them anyway, and it would help. It would make a healthier, more prosperous world anyway.
All right, thanks a lot, Laurie. And Samantha.
Well, I have got a BSc, but it's only in maths and statistics, so it's not a real science. And it's a 2-2, and I got it from the Open University. But more to the point, it doesn't really qualify me at all to tell anybody what we ought to be doing or not doing, because that's not even a question for scientists. You know, we need the information and the evidence the scientists give us, but these are political questions. What should we do about underdeveloped countries? What we should be doing is helping them to develop instead of holding them back. There's one nuclear power station. I know Martin's bored about nuclear power. There's one nuclear power station in the entire continent of Africa, right? And a lot of the international aid organisations are saying we don't want to fund nuclear because we don't think it's renewable. Like, is there anything more calculated to hold back entire societies from the possibility of developing in a relatively clean, climate-friendly way? It's just nuts. I think the opportunity cost, whoever it was said, that the risk of not developing things to adapt is enormous. I think the risk of not doing things is harder to see than the risk of doing things, but it's just as bad, and in many cases worse, because not only do we lose out on the opportunities, we lose out on the better lives people could be having, but we gradually lose our own sense of ourselves as human beings who could be doing something positive.
All right, Greg, we thank the whole panel.